Welcome to the Quarter Three Results for Aero Global. My name is Caroline, and I'll be your coordinator for today's event. Please note this call is being recorded, and for the duration of the call, your lines will be on listen-only mode. However, you'll have an opportunity to ask questions at the end of the call. This can be done by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad to register your questions. If you require assistance at any point, please press star 0 and you'll be connected to an operator. On the call today, we have Zach Dewey, Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer, and Phil Shepherd, Chief Commercial Officer. I will now hand over the call to your host, to Zach Dewey, to begin today's conference. Thank you.
Thank you, operator. As introduced, I'm Zach Dewey, founder and CEO and CIO of Aero. So going to the Q3 results, we're pleased with the progress, particularly the strategic progress we've made in driving the business, as we've discussed it in the capital light strategy that we've been pursuing for the last 5 years. I think as you see on page 3, we've had widespread progress in this most recent period, and you really can see year on year, as you see from the metrics on page 3, the significant progress the business is making. So funds under management very considerably up at 75% higher than year ago period. That reflects the progress we made with raising ACO2 combined with Maslow and Eagle Street now being wholly owned companies of the group. The capital light EBITDA continues to grow. Obviously, part of that is just a direct reflection of the bigger funds under management. Albeit, as you know, funds under management contribute to income on a lagging basis, i.e. they come into the business and then create the annuity income streams that follow. And so you'd expect those numbers to converge over time and capital light to continue to rise as that funds under management all become fee delivering. Deployment has also gone up considerably. That is the result of us having both the larger funds as well as the larger platform footprint. We'll talk about that quite extensively on this call. That's led to a significant growth in free cash flow. As you know, we only co-invest at the 10% level alongside ACO2, where we previously co-invested at 25% on ACO1 and 100% in our historical balance sheet business. And so you see the free cash flow going up considerably as our own co-invest comes down whilst the deployment is going up. This has allowed us to achieve what was our strategic ambition, which is the ability to deploy considerably more, grow the franchise and the business while deleveraging simultaneously. And the next two metrics really show that obviously leverage has come down from 4.1 to 3.6 times, and secured net debt has come down as well, including $19 million in the period. You'll continue to see that progression. We've obviously done a couple of things there. One, with the higher deployment, we're co-investing alongside the funds there, which is also utilizing capital. We've also obviously completed the purchases of Maslow Details, Eagle Street, and BCC, as we've announced in prior periods. And so whilst we've sold Mars and CapQuest in the UK, which weren't contributing to our fund origination, we have acquired these four other businesses that particularly strengthen us on the lending and the real estate side. But as you see in these activities, it's working, right? I mean, basically, CapQuest and Mars contributed less than 1% of our fund originations in recent periods, where obviously Maslow Details, Eagle Street, BCC, and the rest of the Aero franchise powered by ACO2 has led to a very considerable increase in deployment, which is obviously the leading indicator of future capital light income growth. And so across this, we're quite pleased with the strategic progression of both the footprint that has enabled that and across the deleveraging that's occurred, and obviously the growth of funds under management and the corresponding deployment, which is already showing in a stronger capital light EBITDA number, and that will only accelerate as all of the funds under management become fee eligible. As we move to page 4, some greater detail on that. The deleveraging was driven by stronger collections. Phil will go through that on page 13 in more details, but we're pleased with how that is progressing. We'll talk through a bunch of the issues there in terms of what's gross, what's net now as we co-invest alongside the funds and as the portion of the back book we retained in the interim disposal is now on a net basis. So Phil will help you with that reconciliation, but that result is ahead of ERC and a positive result. And obviously, this is a cash business. The key to this is as we grow this franchise, grow the forward-looking fee income streams and pipeline of fees, we also want to continue to get net debt down in absolute terms, even as our fee income pipeline grows. And we obviously achieved that in this quarter. We want to achieve that by more in coming quarters. In terms of the fund management platform, again, made good progress continuing to grow AUM as you see. Obviously, under SEC rules, we can't announce every single closing, but we've made really good progress on AREO and that program, which initially closed in the spring. You've seen our total FUM rise strongly. And we've started raising ALO, which is our lending fund that wasn't historically possible until we owned all of Maslow. We obviously completed that milestone last quarter, as we announced. And so now that we have that platform alongside the other lending activities we've got in Netherlands, in Ireland, between Vesting, RNHB, Mars Ireland, as well as Maslow in the UK, that gives us a very strong footprint from which to operate in the real estate credit space, which is obviously the overlap of the other real estate activities we do and the credit we've always done. And so that's been another LP-facing program. We've had a couple of years where we were a shareholder in Maslow to effectively pilot that whilst we were a minority in Maslow, and now that we've bought 100% of Maslow last quarter, we have the opportunity to bring that fully inside the Arrow fold and add it completely to our FUM and grow it accordingly. And we've already succeeded in having crossover investors with Maslow since that acquisition, and we continue to drive that forward. So you'll see us continue to grow FUM across all three categories, across ACO, where obviously that flagship fund is fully closed and will open again, in a couple of years' time. And lending, which will grow strongly now with that footprint now fully 100% owned and part of the franchise, and AREO, where we've already had the first closing and where that platform is also strengthened. That platform is fed well from Eagle Street, Norfin, BCC, Sansidoni, our fully owned real estate platforms, which contribute to good deal flow in that space. And so all of those lending, special sits, distressed, and real estate equity platforms are contributing now both to the deal flow and with products that are aligned to those platform footprints, and that's what's driving the FUM growth that you've seen, that 75% increase in FUM, and that very significant increase you've seen in the deployment. And so that franchise progression is really good evidence of the success we've had in operating this Arrow model of having the strong local servicing, feeding the investment program, leading to very successful fundraising and deployment and collections. And again, Phil will walk you through the numbers that sit behind that. But I think you see all of that progression is visible in all the headline numbers that are coming through. Returns remain strong, so obviously the macro is challenging for certain asset classes, and so we've lost a point on ACL1, 18 dropping to 17. We're still quite happy with that. I still think that's going to come out as a very strong relative fund performance for funds that were raised pre the interest rate rises last year. But again, we've almost have $1 billion of realizations now in ACL1, so we've been way out ahead of any slowing macro on effectively taking risk out of that ACL1 number. And with that much of it collected and still at a 17. We feel really good about that performance. Obviously, that macro is making ACO2 easier to deploy on even better returns. And we've had a very strong Q3 on ACO2, deploying over $260 million, beating the 28% IRR target and beating a 2 multiple, all of which are, high water marks post the GFC. And so the difficult macro has made having dry powder in ACO2 a very attractive place to be. And so that led to, as you see on the bottom page 4, good progression on the EBITDA in our fund management business. You'll continue to see that growth very strongly over coming quarters. It's continued to lead to us winning both fund mandates, but also servicing mandates. We've won some substantial third-party servicing mandates, particularly in Ireland, where the team's done a super job winning 2 very material contracts. And so in a very pleasing way, our servicing AUM is actually, as we move to page 5, up to $77 billion. So that's having absorbed the entire sale of CapQuest and Mars. And despite losing the AUM in CapQuest and Mars, we've actually grown the total AUM from 70 to $77 billion over that period. And so, again, part of that is because we've reinvested in large extent the proceeds of the sales, CapQuest and Mars, on the servicing platform component of that into Maslow, Details, Eagle Street, and BCC. And that's led to both the growth of AUM, the efficacy of what we do in lending, real estate, and credit opportunities, and it's led to the capacity for great origination. We've also, as was mentioned on the prior page and reinforced here, strengthen the leadership of the business. And so Tony McDermott, who joined us from Centerbridge and from Morgan Stanley, she's a great leader for the lending activities, 20-plus years of industry experience. We've competed with each other. We've partnered with each other over the years. We've co-invested together over the years. She's a great addition to the senior team to strengthen the capacity to run a separate lending product. And Zach Vaughn, who led Brookfield in Europe, obviously grew Brookfield from single-digit billions to $34 billion in Europe during his time there, puts him in a great place to lead the standalone real estate activities. And so from a maturity of leadership perspective and the separation of the products, that PM level is starting to form in a way that's highly accretive to both fundraising efforts, deployment efforts, and resilience and expansion capacity in the senior team. As we move to page 6, you see that convert into the deployment. And so, we've deployed, over $1.7 billion if you include the Maslow element. Obviously, having only bought Maslow in the most recent quarter, we haven't put that back into the year. We're only counting it fully in our deployment from here. But if you were to basically look at what is in the platform footprint now, as you see on the top of page 6, basically it's $1.7 billion over the first 9 months by the time you take in the total of Arrow plus the total of Maslow. Those two things together are obviously the big lead indicator of other income, i.e. deploying the capital in NAV-based AUM fund management constructs, whether it's management fees, servicing fees, or carry, all of that is a direct derivative of deployment. And so that fee income forward roll, if you will, you see how it's turbocharged by being basically a origination run rate that is effectively 3x what it was before. And so by actively managing the footprint so that, removing CapQuest and Mars, which were not additive to that origination the same way, putting in Maslow Details, Eagle Street, and BCC alongside the core Arrow footprint, which is already, basically doubled from previous periods, has led us to, a completely transformed capacity to originate interesting trades, obviously with it being a good time in the cycle to deploy into the weaker macro. That's led to really strong traction in our funds across all three areas, i.e. credit opportunities, real estate equity, and lending. So you see all the details of the numbers on the same to the left-hand side of page 6. On the bottom right, you see how the portfolios are performing through. As we described, we're now $1 billion collected in ACO one. We're at 105% of underwrite there against original underwrite. So having absorbed all the macro, we're still beating the original underwrite on the entire fund. On ACO two, we're both beating the underwrite and again, seeing deal flow that from a risk-adjusted perspective is the best we've seen since the financial crisis. And so that vehicle continues to be, very, very exciting. As you guys will remember, it was the largest distressed fund in the world closed in Q1, and therefore, having that dry powder through this period has been a very accretive process for us and our investors. And all of that you'll see coming through the financials in the coming periods as that money gets deployed and becomes fee generative. So with that, let me pass to Phil to talk you through how the quarter went and the details of that forward roll.
Thanks, Zach. Good morning, everyone. I'll start by explaining the cash performance of the group, which is shown on slide 8. Collections were $290 million for the 9 months year-to-date, representing 145% of ERC, and were 5% higher than the same period last year. For the quarter, collections represented 102% of ERC at $59 million. And collections year-to-date do include $91.5 million relating to the 50% divestment of the wholly owned UK portfolios, as we reported at the half year. The strong collections performance has in part driven a 20% increase in adjusted EBITDA and led to a reduction in leverage from 4.1 times to 3.6 times during 2023, with a slight uplift since the half year. The reduction since the year end represents strong progress to our medium term target of 3 times. Free cash generation was $181.8 million for the 9 month period, and free cash flow after investment in new portfolios was $67.4 million, benefiting from the reduced co-investment level for ACO2 and AREO at 10%, rather than 25% for ACO1. As we continue to scale our integrated fund management proposition, management fees and asset management and servicing fees will grow, and in due course we will recognise carried interest. This build in our capital-light revenues, combined with the lower 10% co-investment level, will further improve the cash generation of the business and enable sustainable deleveraging. Moving on to the segmental results and starting with the integrated fund management segment shown on slide 9. The integrated fund management segment represents the capital-light revenues of the group from our integrated asset management and servicing and fund management activities. Reported revenues were marginally up year on year, reflecting a $27.1 million decrease since the performance of the divested UK platforms Mars and CapQuest are no longer included in the reported underlying results. On a like-for-like basis, revenues have grown $29.9 million as we expand our integrated fund management franchise with increased management fees as fund NAV grows and continued strong appetite for our services from customers with asset management and servicing contract wins, as Zach mentioned. Despite the removal of the performance of our UK platforms from the underlying results, and the ongoing investment in expanding our capabilities, EBITDA has increased by 18% to $29.1 million for the year-to-date period. Over the last 12-month period to September 2023, our capital-light EBITDA has risen by 58% to $44.2 million compared with the 12-month period to September 2022. The ongoing build of NAV and operational leverage continues to widen the EBITDA margin, increasing from 16% for the 9 month period to September 2022 to 18.6% for the year to date period in 2023. As I've discussed on prior earnings calls, I expect both the EBITDA and EBITDA margin to continue to grow as we scale FUM, thereby growing management fees, asset management and servicing fees, and in time recognising carried interest, with revenue growth continuing the trend of outpacing cost growth. The progress in developing our three investment strategies will ensure that the group can continue to expand origination, which in turn builds FUM and delivers capitalised earnings growth. FUM has risen to €9.3 billion as at September 2023. The rise during the quarter is predominantly due to the Maslow acquisition. The balance sheet segment results are shown on slide 10. The segment reflects the investment returns of the backbook investments, along with the returns generated on our co-investments in our discretionary funds, such as ACO. The cash performance has continued to be strong, with collections 145% of ERC year-to-date and 102% for the quarter. However, the balance sheet segment EBITDA decreased by £38.5 million to £27.8 million for the nine-month period, predominantly due to, firstly, the accounting treatments of the assets subject to the divestment to Intrum, and secondly, the change in impairment year-on-year. So as noted in previous quarters, no income or costs on the full 100% of the wholly owned UK assets subject to the divestment are included within the underlying results. Under the lockbox mechanism, any under or over performance on the 50% portion retained by Arrow changed the re-recognition value on completion. During the 9 months to September 2022, the EBITDA on these portfolios was circa £17 million, compared with circa £4 million EBITDA on the 50% retained portfolios since completion of the divestment. The impact of the divestment is therefore a year-on-year reduction of circa £13 million to the reported EBITDA of the balance sheet segments. In addition, reflective of the current economic environment, there was impairment of £20.4 million in the year-to-date period, representing circa 2% of the carrying value of the portfolio investments, compared with a £3.8 million write-up in the same period last year. Moving on to slide 11, which shows the group segments and primarily relates to the centrally controlled overhead costs. The segmental loss has increased from £17.7 million to £22.7 million as we continue to scale our operations. Additional costs relating to the build of our fundraising capabilities and the upfront costs of the fund setup for ACO2 and ARIO have been incurred. The year-on-year costs for the quarter are broadly consistent with costs, with for quarter 3, 2023, of £7.3 million compared with £6.7 million in the same period in 2022. This investment is enabling us to scale our operations. We have driven origination growth by 78.5% to a little over £1 billion, not including the Maslow origination. This is a key leading metric to understand our future growth in fee-paying NAV, which drives future capital light income. The full underlying income statement is shown on slide 12, which shows the EBITDA segmental results that I've explained. And just to recap, the loss before tax and adjusting items of £42.2 million does not include any income on 100% of the wholly owned UK portfolios subject to the divestments upon completion, which generated EBITDA of £17 million in the 9 months to 2022, or any profits from the CapQuest or Mars platforms whose results are reported in adjusting items. The result has been negatively impacted by rising interest rates from financing costs, £16.6 million higher than the nine-month period in 2022, reflecting rising interest rates and the costs of maintaining the high levels of liquidity headroom. In addition, as the group grows the euro income, predominantly due to the growth in management fees and in due course carried interest on our funds, the group is maintaining a net euro liability position. The retranslation of this liability position gives rise to some non-cash P&L volatility and was a 3.9 million gain in the 9-month period to 2023. Whilst the economic backdrop remains weak, in part driven by rising interest rates, I continue to be encouraged that we have delivered strong collections performance, as shown on slide 13. Our continued focus on cash performance has driven collections of 290 million, representing 145% of ERC year to date. And these in collections include 91.5 million in respect of the divestment of the UK wholly owned portfolios. Without this impact, performance is broadly in line with ERC. For quarter three, performance was 102.4% of ERC at 59.1 million. Collections in quarter three now include only 50% of the divested portfolios. And importantly, these collections are reported net of servicing costs. 56% of the ERC and therefore collections are now reported net of servicing costs. The chart of collections shows a higher level of gross collections in earlier periods, and therefore, absent any other change, you would expect a decline in reported collections merely reflecting this accounting change. Our collections performance across all types of portfolios and all geographies demonstrates the ability of our local platforms to drive and accelerate collections performance. I believe our ERC continues to reflect assumptions in line with the uncertain outlook and broader economic expectations, and we continue to adopt a cautious approach to the underwriting of new portfolio investments. The free cash flow generation of 182 million during the 9 months to September 2023 is shown on slide 14. Free cash flow exceeded the cash investments on portfolios by 67 million compared with 22 million for the same period last year. Investments are now generally at the 10% co-investment level, and as we scale our business across credit, real estate and lending, the increasing levels of capital-light revenue will continue to drive free cash flow and the deleveraging of the business. Slide 15 shows the net debt position, with net debt reducing by 19 million during the 9-month period. The net cash inflow from investments of 67 million has in part funded the reduction in net debt. As announced at the half year but completed in quarter three, the group acquired the remaining 51% of Maslow with an upfront cash outflow of 40 million. The Maslow acquisition has in part been funded by equity. Over both the initial acquisition of 49% and the second part acquiring 51%, 21 million of equity has been issued to part fund the purchase. The net M&A outflow is 9 million for the year-to-date period, reflecting the outflow in respect of Maslow, partly offset by the cash inflow received of 37.5 million from the sale of the UK platforms to Intrum. This was in addition to the 91.5 million received from the divestment of the portfolios. There was a working cash capital inflow for the quarter of 5 million. Year to date, the working capital outflow was 27 million, driven by the growth of our business, the accrual of Maslow profits prior to full consolidation, and payments arising from the setup of the new discretionary funds. The net debt reduction of 19 million is in line with our strategic goals of reducing leverage and repaying net debt. And going forward, the underlying trading is expected to continue to drive lower net debt, particularly now investments are at the 10% co-investment level and as capital-light integrated fund management EBITDA continues to grow as we expand across credit, real estate and lending. Slide 16 shows our leverage and funding position. The strong collections performance and growing capital-light income have driven the reduction in leverage to 3.6 times from 4.1 times at December 2022. This represents significant progress to our medium-term target of 3 times, and further deleveraging remains a core focus. We have a strong funding base with no bond maturities until 2026. The weighted average term of our debt is 3.5 years, and we had 230 million of liquidity headroom. Our 120-month ERC was 1.3 billion, 23% lower than December 2022, and reflects the divestment of the wholly owned U.K. portfolios, but also the increasing level of our ERC reported net of servicing costs, co-investments made through the fund, and the retained 50% of the wholly owned U.K. portfolios are all reported within the ERC net of servicing costs. Now, approximately 50% of our ERC is reported net of servicing costs. I believe the strength of our liquidity and funding position, together with our capital-light model, leaves us well placed to continue to progress the expansion of our integrated fund manager model across credit, real estate, and lending. This, in turn, further drives capital-light revenue growth without placing strain on our balance sheet and facilitates net debt reduction and further deleveraging towards the strategic leverage commitment of 3 times. Thank you, and I'll now hand back to Zach.
Thanks, Phil. So just in summary and closing on page 18, you really see us continue to progress the business down the same strategic pathway we've been on, frankly, since 2019 when we first started the ACO One fundraise and the capital-light pivot that went with that, which is that basically, as we deploy capital into what's a good environment for deploying capital, given the weak macro and the general higher base rate and illiquidity around us, we generate higher IRRs on our balance sheet contribution, but that balance sheet contribution continues to be a smaller and smaller part of what we do. And while you follow the accounting, the collections going from gross to net, given the accounting rules on fair value through the P&L, the ERC remains a substantial credit underpin, particularly if you then compare it on a like-for-like, net-for-net basis. It remains orders of magnitude in a similar place to previous. But we've, I think, very actively done a number of things that are improving our progression, and I think the evidence of that is visible in today's presentation, which is we continue to strengthen the footprint, which has enabled us to raise the kind of category-leading ACO Two fund, making great progress on our real estate and our lending funds off a stronger footprint that is bolstered by Maslow Details, Eagle Street, and BCC, which we've acquired since the TDR take private. All of that taken together has allowed us to reduce net debt slightly. Our priority is still to reduce net debt substantially. We know the business needs to delever strongly from here. But the pipeline, the feedstock of future fee income, that order book is growing fantastically well. I mean, if you look at both the funds under management up 75% period on period, deployment in the core franchise up 100% period on period, and with the benefit of the full Maslow numbers in the business, deployment on a like-for-like basis is up 300% period on period. It's tripled. So this is working in a very strong way. Obviously, we're all impatient to see the flow-through of that continue and see net debt come down as a consequence and continue to see the business grow strongly, the fee income base grow strongly, the EBITDA from it grow strongly. And as carry comes through, obviously, carry being the most lagging indicator of success, there's zero carry in this presentation, i.e., carry from ACO One is still to come, and then obviously ACO Two and the other two funds. And so as you see that continue to progress, I think while we all are impatient to get to the destination as fast as possible, I think the feedstock and the contributing parts to get that pivot to deliver what we want it to are going ahead of where we'd expect to be, and we're working within our means in terms of using the capital base we've got and getting net debt down whilst completing that pivot, whilst strengthening that franchise, whilst getting both the servicing platforms and the footprints there. And we're also super pleased to see that our platforms are the market-leading facing servicing platforms such that we can sell CapQuest and Mars and actually grow servicing AUM from $70 billion to $77 billion because of the net increase by 10% despite, you know, taking those two platforms out of those numbers. And so, you know, while, you know, a lot of wood to chop and got to get the funds raised, deployed, collected, obviously having collected $1 billion on ACL1 is strong progress. You know, I think you're starting to see it come through in the core metrics that our progression towards being, you know, one of the most profitable fund managers in the world, as we've shown in prior presentations. The servicing fees, management fees, carry, and the construct of that allow us to earn 40% ROAs on the 10% co-invest we put alongside those funds. And so the core essence of this model is that by having these 19 local platforms that service $77 billion, they put us in a fantastic place to originate strongly, really attractive deals. And then by being the servicer to those deals and the manager to those deals, the fee income capture when co-invest is 10% and fees are on the 90 is just a super accretive business model. And we're all impatient for that to be the very dominant P&L element of all elements of our metrics. But I think we've made massive progress in that regard with funds under management, you know, up 75% and deployment tripling, right? And so that's what the team's focused on. And I think, you know, alongside deleveraging, which is the natural construct of delivering that business model to its fullest, you know, we're pleased with the progress to date. And with that, pass to questions, please.
If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. We will take the first question from line. Last question, this is from Deutsche Bank. The line is open now. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hey, good morning. Three questions from my side. First of all, when I think about the LTM underlying EBITDA, right, excluding the $91.5 million of asset sale proceeds, that is obviously lower by that amount, and hence your leverage on that basis quite a bit higher. I see it around 5 times this quarter, and it's also up, call it 0.4 on that basis sequentially. Now I think that is, however, distorted by the Maslow consideration for the remaining 51% stake. So the first question really would be, what is the EBITDA contribution from that asset, assuming you will now obviously control it? And, you know, can you maybe also just repeat again, I think you said it on the call, what the consideration here was in terms of equity and cash paid?
Yeah, Phil, do you want to just take those?
Yeah. So I mean, you know, clearly the adjusted EBITDA of the realization of the 91.5 million is a slight one off, but clearly we don't have those collections coming through in future periods. So the collections now are just at the 50%, and therefore, you know, just completely removing that from the calculation is clearly is not correct either. And you know, I think we debate that in terms of the you know, the collections performance. We obviously we're pleased with the collections performance. It obviously is we've had that transition from more of it being reported net to gross. We're delivering at an ERC level, you know, broadly in line with our ERC. And you know, we should remember that we get a slightly lumpy collections profile. given the nature of our portfolios. And therefore, I think the most important thing for this business is the transition to the integrated fund manager model that we you know, talking about at length. And I accept that people are focused upon the leverage number, but in many respects the bigger story is how we grow those capitalized income streams. And as we've sort of stipulated on many calls and bondholder conferences, the origination level is the sort of key leading metric, because that's what drives the fee paying NAV, which drives the capital light income streams, which is the strong indicator of progression that we're making, and clearly the figure that we reported this time is very strong.
Phil, you know, in terms of EBITDA contribution, maybe, and also about EV, what you paid, I think 40 million was the outlay in Q3, but then there was also an equity component, and maybe remind us as well what has been done beforehand for the 49%.
We'll see that in the first half of this year we reported 3 million for Maslow profits, which represents the 49% for a 6 month period. So if you annualize that and gross it up to the 100%, you're effectively a 12 million implied profit. We acquired that over the two portions. The first portion was 37 million, and we've paid 64 million for the second portion, which comprised the 40 million cash outflow, 21 million of equity across both portions, and 15 million of deferred consideration.
Got it.
Yeah. So it's about 100 million in total, and we paid, there's 50 million of deferred consideration, 21 million of equity, and the rest was cash.
Gotcha. And when you refer to profit, you mean net income, I assume?
Yes.
Or is that an EBITDA number? Okay, got it. All right. Thank you. No, that's helpful. And then the other thing, on operating working capital, there was a small inflow, as you said, in your part, 5 million in the quarter, but it's still overall a 27 million outflow. What is driving it? And, you know, can we expect in Q4 a reversal? Like, will we see further inflows, or will this remain around these levels, an outflow for the full year?
Yeah, I think in terms of as you grow the business and get servicing mandates, there is inevitably a working capital outflow, because you generally pay people before you get the servicing fees coming in, particularly where you have new mandate wins, where there is a sort of a build up of people and build up of cost ahead of the realization of those servicing fees. So I wouldn't expect any significant inflows, outflows for Q4. As we've seen in Q3, we had a small inflow. I'd expect a sort of small inflow outflow for Q4.
Right, and down the line, when we think about next year, like, shall we think about this now as a structural theme where we see net working capital outflows on the back of you guys expanding your servicing business, or will there be any change?
I mean, working capital predictions are incredibly difficult to give, as I'm sure you appreciate. I wouldn't expect any significant inflows, outflows from working capital on a go-forward basis, though.
Okay. And then very, very quickly, the last one, if we think now about 24 and we think about the adjusted EBITDA bridge, it looks like, as per the ERC you disclosed today, that your collections from the back book alone are supposed to be roughly 70 million higher compared to what you had for year one ERC as of Q4 22. And that, you know, at a margin, at an incremental margin of maybe 80% or so, I mean, should give you a loan 55 to 60 million of incremental cash EBITDA. What about the front book? Can you, you know, give us more color there in terms of where purchases will go? Obviously, it will be driven by the co-invest percentage. But any sort of ballpark compared to this year, I think cash flow wise, we have seen now 115 or 20 million of outflows in the first 9 months. And also related to that, maybe are you investing those at, you know, higher spot rates, higher spot IRRs that you are seeing in the market? Or are these returns you are locking in there different from the spot market because it's forward flow or whatever it might be? That would be interesting too.
Yeah, I mean, we don't do many forward flow agreements. So, broadly speaking, our purchases will be not far off 10% of our origination volumes. There will be some small purchases, as we've discussed previously, where we support our servicing platforms. But broadly speaking, it'll be 10% of the origination volumes. The rates that we're earning on that, I think we've told you, you know, where ACO2 is generating, a 20% return overall, and for the quarter was 21%. So that's the returns that are being generated.
Fair enough. And remind me, you said like you still try to originate over $1 billion a year. So at 10%, roughly 100 million is still a fair ballpark in terms of your own balance sheet purchases for next year. Is that right?
I think where we are, I mean, clearly as we've spoken about, you know, we've acquired those platforms, and therefore, you know, we've originated a little over €1 billion. In the 9 months to date, and that's without Maslow. So I think we would hope that we're slightly ahead of that figure for origination during the course of next year as we continue to expand.
Yeah. Got it. And then on the fund management side, which is really the last building block, and the carry you mentioned, like can you quantify anything around that already, or is that something you want to do when you report full year numbers?
Yeah, I think carry will probably come 2025, so it's still a little while off. I think we guided to around about a 40 million share for the corporate. That's still broadly where we're expecting.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Let me be clear, that 40 million is ACO1 yeah. only. It doesn't include ACO2 or the other products.
Thank you, Zach. Okay, thank you both.
Thanks, Clive. Appreciate it.
Thank you. We will take the next question from line Carl Strecker from Guggenheim. The line is open now. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. can you disclose the fee-paying AUM in the quarter?
It's a little over two billion.
Understood. And also the the management fee income. Can you disclose that? Because I guess from our perspective, as we try and model this going forward, those are, you know, very important to allow us to model them. So the management fee income in the quarter relative to that fee-paying AUM.
Yeah, I know we've discussed this point previously. The integrated fund manager model means that we view the returns across different areas as integrated. So the servicing of and the origination. So we don't disclose that figure separately.
But how should we model this going forward then? Because obviously we go into 2024, presumably at some stage next year, you're probably looking at or thinking about a refinancing. And, you know, how should we model it? Because I guess from our perspective, we've had the Mars sale in the period, which strategically makes a lot of sense, but, you know, clearly makes the numbers very difficult to parse out. But, you know, I guess, you know, as we've discussed, you could take out the 90 million of the sales and you could make the adjustments that you've given us in terms of the 17 and the 7 million in the prior year. And I guess what that gets us to is 5x leverage. So really what you're asking us to do is look forward to the continued development of the fund management income and then also the collections expectation next year. But how should we manage that fee light income if we don't have any of, how should we model that if we don't have any of these metrics? It's impossible to model. We've got, you know, no metrics to model it.
Can I maybe, Phil, if I pick up the kind of how we think about it from a business model perspective, give you a moment, you can comment if you want, Phil, after on the specifics. I think the we agree with some of that, and let us talk through where we're heading. So, I mean, we're clearly building a large total funds under management business. And some of those, the vast majority, are on the Arrow platforms. Almost all of them have servicing fee contribution. Some of them have management fee contribution, and the portion of that that's growing is growing very quickly, just given the size of the funds we've raised and given the size of the deployment. All of that's moving from effectively a latent phase into a fully, you know, depending on the product, basis points, you know, the highest we get is about 175 basis points down to, you know, lower fee rates against deployed NAV effectively. And then obviously carry is deleted, but Phil answered that in the prior question. And so what we've said to bond investors up till now is that when you take the compendium of that, when you add up those fee streams, plus assuming a net 10% return on the asset, that basically the asset will do 10 on a net, like effectively equivalent triple net on a net after everything basis, and that we'll get another effectively 30 points of ROA from the combination of management fee, servicing fees, and carry. And that is accurate, right? So for every dollar we raise, that 40% ROA, 10 points of it coming from the asset side and 30 points of it coming from the three different fee streams is an accurate summary of that. I guess the reason we've been kind of reticent to be more explicit is it is a range, you know, we have 19 servicing platforms that do a range of different activities across lending, real estate, and credit opportunities. And it's not that we don't charge one fee for doing a mortgage in the Netherlands down to doing a bankruptcy in Italy. Like, if you can imagine, the fee register goes on. I think it's 26 pages long, right? And so
all we can realistically disclose is you see a number of AUM come in the top and coming out, you need to see what the ROA that comes to us is off that AUM, because obviously if we tried to do it bottoms up, we'd be disclosing 26 pages of fees and having to create vastly intricate segmentals. So that's the summary of the why. Having said all of that, I have a lot of sympathy for your question, and I agree that as we come towards a refinance, we need to be effectively more foot forward to say, okay, this is effectively the order book of each of the fees. We're obviously going to need to give you an order book view of carry, an order book view of management fees, an order book view of servicing fees with enough level of detail so investors can follow through for every fundraising success we've had in the different areas and every deployment success and wherever we perform, which bits of that is performance dependent like carry and which bits of it are effectively captive fee income streams like management fee and servicing fees, which are not anywhere near as performing contingent. So that's what's going on in the underlying commercial math. Hopefully that all makes sense. How we then give you guidance on every step of the journey quarter by quarter, I guess up till now, but by effectively publishing the headline progression of those and telling you on an average basis what the fee accretion is from the fees on the 90% that's third party capital, hopefully we've given a basis for you to track that progression. But we agree that before any refinance, we're going to need to, and by then, as you see, at the rate we're growing, the business will be substantially more mature at that stage. Carry will be closer. The AUMs will be larger. What's lending, what's real estate, and what's the ATO series will all be at a much more mature state. And so at that stage, it may be easier to publish mature product metrics that are easily digestible. You can put a model and just track each line for its contribution one by one. But that's what's really going on. And then the question, I guess, Phil, to you is any other guidance you can give now so that someone who wants to model it quarter to quarter between now and then can track the progression. But maybe I hand over to you on that basis.
Yeah, I mean, and I think in terms of how this grows, I mean, and the 40% return on the assets that we've sort of stipulated, and I think I've said on prior calls that's broadly split equally between the four areas: the management fee, the servicing fee across those different types of servicing. The average is out to about 10%, 10% for carry, assuming we hit target returns, and then 10% for the balance sheet return, which is after an internal allocation of management fee, broadly speaking. And the way that the NAV and the fee paying NAV grows, what now we're investing 10% is that the origination volumes, origination times by the weighted average life, assuming you keep investing at the consistent level, that would grow to a NAV of origination times the weighted average life, and so that gives you the broad metrics of how this will progress. The other dynamic to that is how much we're having to invest now to build the origination volume. So, you know, we've mentioned that we've been growing organically our bridge lending capabilities. So clearly that involves recruiting a number of people who initially are not generating any income. And that's really the difficulty in providing any guidance, is that as we're in this build phase, those incremental investments that we're making are disproportionate to the you know the fee income that we're generating as we're scaling. And so as Zach mentions, as we get to a more mature state, which we intend to get to before you know the refinancing, and we've got sufficient time, then I think, you know, providing that guidance ahead of any refinancing will be far easier, because those investment lines will be a smaller portion of the total as we see EBITDA from the capital light income streams grow.
From my perspective, like, you know, I know you're saying there's some complexity there, but if I just look at the fund management income, like, that's fees that you're charging, you know, vast majority, presumably, to a handful of funds. So, you know, it's at a blended fee rate, depending on what your underlying clients are paying, and you've given us the fee paying AUM. So I struggle to understand why you couldn't disclose the fund management income, and then the residual of the servicing. And clearly there's a range of, depending on the collection activity or type that's undertaken. But yeah, I know you're kind of talking about, you know, coming to a refinancing. Why can't you disclose that now and, you know, improve your cost of capital coming into a refinancing? Because at the moment, frankly, like, all of the narrative makes complete sense and it's compelling, but when we look at the numbers, we obviously have huge noise from Mars, and, you know, frankly, if we just look at the basic numbers, EBITDA is down significantly year over year in this quarter. We strip out Mars, so we can't tell the story of that fund management growth as it stands, and it doesn't seem like it's difficult to disclose the average fee-paying AUM and the fund management income on a quarterly basis in order for us to be able to, you know, track that and then model it annualizing and growing going forward.
Go ahead, Phil. I was going to say, yeah, no, I mean, and we completely understand, and you know, once the some of the noise of the growing pains, if you like, are out of the numbers and they make more sense, then we will do. We'll look at it for year end, certainly.
Carl, the last year that. Just think through the nature of how the fee constructs work, right? You spend whatever the cost it is to raise a fund, you know, which can be 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 million euros or even more, depending on how the size of the fund, including an in-house fundraising team. The cost of the management team, which in the existing categories was already embedded and profiting from obviously a large back book as well as the forward origination, but for new categories, and obviously today we've announced a lending fund construct with the benefit of 100% Maslow ownership, and as Phil described, you know, that comprises a whole bunch of real estate categories, bridge lending, for example, where we've added 5 people but haven't put through the deployment yet because it just joined. But obviously from the captive funds, that's in our control. There is just noise in those numbers. I agree with you. We could seek to break all of that out whilst in flight and separate all the parts, and you guys would then be able to track every line item of every product all the way through. I think that is a pretty high reporting segmental burden given we do 19 different platforms worth of things, but we agree with you that we need to provide more clarity on this, and we will. I think the other issue that is probably at the root cause of some of why we're taking this approach is, I mean, from our perspective, the vertically integrated model is a different operating model where we get the benefit of management fees, servicing fees, and the overhead recharge that goes with those funds, we get those on a vertically integrated basis back to Arrow, obviously. And so from a practical perspective, we view all of those fees as captive. And, you know, the equity markets have historically drawn great distinction between management fee and carry. And we're supportive of that distinction. We think carry obviously is performance contingent, where management fees are generally less so. And so we agree with that distinction. But from our perspective, the servicing fees and any overhead recovery is part of that same captive income stream. And so from a future role look at what, I mean, we're not public anymore, so we're not in that regard focused on hour-to-hour equity perspective. But from an equity perspective on the go forward, our view is that, you know, obviously those fee streams are captive, and the day we raise the fund and the day we deploy the fund and hire our own servicing platform, that is a captive income stream. And so if you were in our shoes, drawing great distinction between those different income streams is not a sensible equity oriented approach. So we're not yet at the point of refinance. We have a lot of business maturing. The reason we did the take private was so that we could do this reconstruction without, you know, dealing with the equity noise of that every day. We're doing a really good job of getting that done. I agree with you that you guys need to see all that broken out to understand it. How much of that is non-recurring cost because it went with raising the prior funds? How much of that is the noise from the Mars CapQuest sale, which was not core to mission, so we sold it? How much of that is already now successfully into feedstock? Obviously, the fact that we had $9.3 billion of FUM is a huge order book of future deal flow, and the fact that we're deploying it at 3x what we did, inclusive of Maslow prior, is there. So that's what's happening in the business. We know you guys are going to need a way to model that accurately on the roll forward, and we're super sympathetic to it, but the reason we haven't provided it is that the combination of the surgery of taking CapQuest and Mars out and putting Maslow and a lending fund and a real estate fund in on the one hand, and our downstream equity preference of the world seeing our captive fees being our management fees, servicing fees, and overhead recharges one, because it is entirely captive to us raising the funds. We have that preference of how to present it for that downstream reason. We understand we're going to need to compromise that to give you enough visibility to analyze this and to show where the forward roll trajectory is of that fee order book. As you say, that's a significant part of the credit story on the refinance, but we're just not there yet. I mean, I mean, we don't have a first maturity until 2026. So we've got time to deliver it on the ground and then make it clear as to the exact forensics of how that rolls forward. But we hear you. We know we need to do it. We're just chopping the wood to get this nailed so that you've got the forward roll that makes sense off what the actual forward platform is with the products that are there to grow with it.
But just to be clear, I'm just talking about the revenue income. Are you saying that some of the fund's startup costs are netted against that income? Because, you know, if you're just providing income at this stage, you're not going to need to get into all the costs and recurring versus non-recurring.
So you can take that as to what's been expensed and how that works.
Yeah. I mean, the revenue is clearly just the revenue. There is no netting.
Right. So you know, that should make it. And I guess we're not asking for. And I've spoken to other people about this. We're not asking for, you know, two pages or 10 line items or whatever. We're just asking for an AUM figure and a management fee or fund management income figure. You know, at least as a starting point, it doesn't seem that complicated. And I guess it's hard for me to rationalize why you wouldn't provide that. And I understand your integrated model, but really, unless you're, you know, I think you're looking at it from the perspective of a locked up fund and it's a multi-year fund, then you can take that multi-year view in terms of the returns. But the reality is that, you know, we as investors can't take a multi-year period. You know, we look at it quarterly, but the minimum we could look at it over is annual. And, you know, at the moment, it's just very difficult. So, look, I appreciate the comments that you've made.
And let's take it away. We'll look at it for the year end. Yeah. We hear you, Carl. Thanks.
Understood. And I guess the last question I have then is just, as you think about your cash on balance sheet versus the drawn RCF, you know, relatively large carry cash position at the end of the quarter, is there any reasons for that, or do you have less drawings on the RCF in quarter, for example?
No, I mean, there's clearly a reasonable level of cash, which is just operational cash. So, particularly in some of the territories, which it's more efficient with withholding tax, just to keep some of the cash down in territory rather than repatriating it and suffering withholding tax, particularly in some of the southern European territories. So there's no reason for that. I mean, that balance has come down, and will continue to come down as the sort of the back book runs off and that operational cash within territories reduces.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Carl.
Thank you. We will take the next question from line Bruno Redcutting from PGIM. The line is open now. Please go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, guys. Thank you for the presentation. I guess just firstly, it'd be useful to understand your confidence in next year's ERC number, and just maybe to understand a bit of the phasing of that. Obviously, over the past, you know, obviously, as you kind of moved away from unsecured more into secure, your collection profile's been quite lumpy, but, you know, you've got close to 400 million of ERC on your balance sheet expected to be collected next year. Could you just kind of talk through the phasing of that and, I guess, your confidence in that number and the potential for any of that to get pushed into 25?
Yeah, I think clearly there are some more significant collections, portfolio collections in next year's ERC. I think the ERC is our best estimate of where we expect that to happen. Overall, I would say I'm reasonably confident that we'll achieve that figure. Clearly, it's difficult. You know, we don't know what's going to happen to the macroeconomic environment. But absent any changes, then we've got pretty good visibility on the realization of those portfolios. What I probably don't have as much confidence and visibility on is basically whether they will hit in, you know, a Q1 to Q2 or a Q2 to Q3. But overall, I think we sit pretty confident in terms of where we are and the visibility we've got on the realizations as they're coming through. But whether they the profile in year is probably slightly something that is probably still potential for change.
Okay, all right, thank you. And obviously, establishing that number gets achieved. Could you just kind of talk about the deleveraging profile you expect to see over the coming year as well, and I guess the absolute net debt reduction attached to that? You know, obviously, I mean, you've had this 3x medium-term target since, you know, the initial underwrite that we did back in 2020. We're obviously, you know, I'd say halfway, if not a bit over, towards that medium-term target in terms of timings, but obviously leverage has gone up, not down. So it'd just be useful to understand, I guess, the cadence of the deleveraging going forward, and I guess baked into that your M&A as well, because I guess that's been a bit of a a slowdown on the deleveraging?
Yeah, I guess what we're trying to build here is the integrated fund manager model. And I go back to the importance of, you know, the investment that we're making to scale the operation, because the, you know, at a 40% return on capital, you want to grow your origination and your fee paying NAV. That's one of the key drivers of future deleveraging and future profitability. And as Zach says, we're equally as impatient than you guys to see, you know, it come through the metrics. But unfortunately, you know, it does take time to come through. So to answer the question about, you know, the how does this balancing act between deleveraging and growing the growing our origination capability and growing our fund management capability. We think we've made some really sensible investments to be able to hugely improve our fund management proposition with the acquisitions that we've made, so that we can develop those three investment strategies across real estate, credit and lending, and we think we're making really good progress on that. Clearly next year is a really strong collections year. So, you know, when you look at the 400 million of collections, and you sort of compare that to you know, what we would be, generating this year, then, if you add the sort of 80 million of ERC left for Q4 this year to the 290 of collections, you're at 370, and that includes the 91 million of the divestment. If you compare that to the 400 million we've got next year, then you should see, really strong progress to our deleveraging. And that doesn't, include any of the uplift that you'd see and the progression of the IFM, EBITDA from those capital light earnings. So I accept that, you know, if you back out the 91, then, you know, you can get to a figure of sort of five times. But when you look forward to 2024, then, we should see, strong progress towards that three times goal that we've spoken about.
Maybe I could just add one more thing, which is the other bit of the economics that lay into that answer and that question are the M&A and that 90 that we've taken out by way of the Mars CapQuest sale. I mean, obviously we've effectively reinvested that across Maslow Details, Eagle Street, and BCC. Those were useful, if not essential, platform strengthenings that have basically given us a critical mass to then raise a standalone real estate product and a standalone lending product alongside the ACO flagship product. And so as you forward roll the business, whilst we reinvested the Mars CapQuest sale proceeds in effect into those four platforms, the growth that's come off those is very strong, as you see in the headline figures we showed today. I don't think we need to continue that. It's done now, that's what we needed to do to get the real estate and the lending strategies to a sufficient critical mass that we could raise funds for those separate strategies. Obviously, by hiring Tony and Zach, as we mentioned, it's given us a very strong leadership of those separate strategies to go alongside the core ACO franchise. That gives us, as a together group, when you run the forward role, the requisite deployment rate and AUM acquisition rate to give us effectively the escape velocity we want towards having capital light grow at the speed we need it to grow to delever the way we want to grow. And we appreciate you guys need to see that play out, i.e. this is in the show me phase as we get into 24, 25, and 26 for that to play true. But we don't need to make any material relevant acquisitions to support what we now have across those three product categories, and those three product categories are deploying enough and raising enough to achieving the forward profile that is attractive. And so, this is basically the bottom of that pivot where the back book plays through. Obviously, the fact that 56% of it is now shown net versus a third of it shown net last year and only 14% of it being net when this pivot started. So, I mean, comparing prior periods to this isn't really apples to apples, right, of what's shown gross versus fair value through the P&L that we under accounting have to show net. So it's not that we've eaten the back book very much. We haven't. Once you do the gross net realignment, it's a little smaller, but not a lot. And then net debt has come down a little bit. It's got to come down a bunch more. That's obvious. But I think having now reduced our co-invest share from 25% to 10%, and we'll see if we can get that down further over time in the different products, and getting the M&A done, which is obviously funded effectively by selling Cat Plus and Mars, but leading to a doubling of core footprint period over period origination and a tripling inclusive of Maslow, which is just entering the numbers this quarter. I think we're in a place where we've got the business where we want it. We just now need to forward roll it on that basis and then make it visible to you guys now that surgery is finished what the forward business is, which is obviously a 40% ROA business on all a rapidly growing fund manager, right? And that's where this is going. And I think, obviously there's a lot of noise in the numbers between the gross and the net, between us not being allowed to recognize revenue in the first half of the year on what we sold to Intrum, which is a pretty crazy accounting feature. And then basically the one-off sale would be reinvested. I think as you look forward, I think that noise goes away over the forward 12 months, carry comes into the denominator, and you wind up where we intend to be at the point of refinance, right? I mean, that is this business. We just need to continue to deliver it, which we've made a lot of progress on, and then make it in a way that you guys find easy to model, which we hear you needs to get there.
Okay, understood. So you're basically saying we're kind of, because I think the market obviously is stripping out that MacBook sale to Intrum out of your EBITDA number, but you're basically saying we're kind of at a trough. Collections next year will be strong. There's no more M&A to think about, so we should see strong free cash flow, which will go towards paying down debt. And then obviously at the same time, you have the strong capital light coming through, which we shall see. So you're just basically saying this is the trough.
Exactly that.
There we go. Okay, understood. And I guess just lastly, and I mean, I think I've echoed the comments that I made before, and I know you've done a lot of time explaining that, but could you just give us any sort of qualitative guidance about how we should think about the growth in the capital light stream? Because I fully appreciate the returns you're talking about, model it out myself to understand it, but just in terms of how we should think about the servicing and the AUM, I appreciate the carries more of a 25 thing, but how we should think about those earnings grow into next year, because obviously for modeling out the cash flows for your business, which is important for us as debt investors, we kind of need to know you know, modeling out the cash flows from the back book is pretty straightforward to do, but obviously those capital light ones are difficult, and I know you don't want to put hard numbers on it, but could you just kind of help us, you know, is it kind of hockey stick growth you're looking at? Is it kind of similar growth to what you've seen this year and last year? Like, just how should we be thinking about that, just purely from a top line perspective?
Yeah, so I mean, the origination volume is the key metric there, and so, you know, the growth in the fee paying NAV is essentially, you know, the origination less your collections, and I'm referring to the collections of across the entire. The entire fund, rather than just Arrow's collections, and so you know I've sort of referred a couple of times this morning around the importance of that metric, and that's why I've referred to it, is because that is what drives that fee paying NAV, which drives the management fees, which drives the build of carry, even though the cash comes later. But in terms of and then obviously the servicing, the average servicing of that, the 10% return on assets, so sort of, you know, a 1% on the NAV figure as our servicing profits. So in terms of how that builds, it builds based upon the build of origination building into the NAV. The other element is on the cost side, which is the you know, how much we're investing in people and you know, as we scale the business, and I think from that perspective, we're largely through that. You know, we've obviously hired Tony and Zach this time. I think we're pretty much there with the, you know, the fundraising team that we've led by Charlotte Gilbert, who we've announced previously. So we're pretty much there on our on that expansion of investment in people. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I get the broad-based numbers. I guess what the market is asking for is a bit more sort of context around how that evolves on a timing basis, because, you know, as you say, the carry is far out. You know, there's a ramping phase attached to it as well. And I guess, you know, the way we look at this is just trying to see the incremental story, which, as you said, you know, I think you said it yourself, there's a lot of noise in these numbers. I would say it'd be helpful if you bridged those and gave us performance the rest of it, but you haven't done that. So it's just trying to get the qualitative make sense, which I think people have said on prior questions asked and calls, but it's just the context around that. It's just still very hard to get that. But, you know, appreciate you will give more colour the full year.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
Thank you, we will take the next question from line Marina Lulen from Chinawa. The line is open now, please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. I don't want to harp too much on this, but I really would appreciate that if you can just split out the IRRs across your different divisions. The servicing fee should be pretty straightforward, as you've been sort of doing that as a bread and butter for some time, so that should be separate. But, I mean, shouldn't you have a model portfolio and an MOIC expectation for each of your sort of funds? Like, how do you even pitch to investors? I mean, it seems like it would be very logical to have sort of an idea of your MOICs. This would need to be a bit clearer and a bit straightforward as we sort of refinance. At least I, as a bondholder, don't feel comfortable right now with like hearing how little disclosure and clarity that there is around your fees. I have a small fund that we're setting up, and I know each and every line item. I know my counsel fees. I know my settlement fees. There is nothing that I don't know line by line. I mean, of course, it's a much smaller AUM than what you're sort of running, and I appreciate that you're doing different things. But but it seems very unnatural to be raising money and not really have a model portfolio or an ability to really disclose the different layers of fees. That's just, I don't want to be snarky, but it just, as a bondholder of some of a decent portion of a bonds, this call right now just made me a bit uneasy, and I just, I'm looking for clarity.
I think we're, I separate that into three different things, and some of it's easy and some of it we'll provide. So the first thing is just kind of direct comparison, as you talk about kind of comparing a high yield fund to what we do. You appreciate you've got the Credit Opportunities Fund, which does generally NPLs, bankruptcy claims, restructurings, secondary credits. You've got the Lending Fund, which does specialty mortgages, different types of bridge lending, construction lending, agricultural lending. Those are things that came in with Maslow and some of the other parts. And then you've got real estate equity, which is much easier, right? And it's on Eagle Street and Northfin, et cetera. So we've got three different fund products. Obviously, the PPMs on those funds and the track record that goes against each of those funds is hugely detailed and does exactly what you said. We have, in previous periods, in our capital market days, et cetera, gone through what is the MOIC on each one, what are the IRRs on each one, what is the fee construct on each one. Certainly taking the feedback from today, we can do another capital markets day, which will make that clear. I think that in due course makes a lot of sense. Obviously, a lot of this is recent. I mean, the Maslow component and the lending fund we've only announced today, and we've only taken full control of Maslow today, in the most recent quarter. And on the real estate equity side, we announced the first one back in April. So some of those are new. The ACL one we've shown in prior capital market days and is obviously our largest sequence. So, happy to over time update those numbers. But, yes, that's obviously very clear in terms of what the MOICs are.
Okay. Yeah.
What the IRRs are and what the fees are. But if that's what you're missing, we can either cover that offline or update our capital markets out.
That would be amazing, because we know that you guys are extremely smart, and this is what the reason why we're in there. But just some clarity. I'm sure you can give that. I mean, to some extent, across these sort of segments, and I think that would be great if you could do that. Thank you. And how does it vary for AOC one, the asset base, to what you're doing, and AOC two? Is there a difference in terms of like focus across the different sort of fee pools, so real estate versus lending and the NPLs, is there more skewed towards one or the other? Has that changed at all?
No, so the core deal flow that exists in ACO1 and ACO2 are extremely similar. The ACO being its NPLs, bankruptcies, restructuring, secondary credits. I mean, that the ACO1, ACO2 series is very similar between those activities, and obviously that we've been doing versions of that since 2005 as it's played through. So there's a huge track record of data there. That's easy to work through. We can work through that with you offline. I think the and again, happy over time to do a capital markets day that explains that. I think ALO, which is the lending categories that came with Maslow, obviously is a different wall and a different fee capture in those categories. That's lending against real estate credit in the different forms between specialty mortgages, bridge loans, and the development activity. And then and historically, as we told the market, I mean, we've not invested our balance sheet alongside that product, right? That product has been all third-party LP money. And then you've got the third one, which is the one we announced last in April, is the real estate equity opportunities. That's deep value real estate. Again, comes off the same $77 billion that we service and comes off the Eagle Street, Northfin, San Sedoni, MVCC platforms. And that's, you know, as you'd expect for real estate equity in this environment, that's 20 plus IRRs, that's 2 plus multiples. We can go through that again.
Yeah, and that's net of all fees, the IRR, the 20% net of financing fees, per fee.
Net of everything, it's effectively the deal level. So it's after servicing fees, it's after the things that go with the deal. It's pre-management fee and pre-carry. It's net of everything else. Basically.
Okay, so that would be.
And we'll go through that. I think let's go through that in a structured way. Yeah. I think the pieces to why it's not directly analogous to a high yield fund is that the underlying activity that goes with that. So just to give you a sense, I mean, ATO1 has 350 investments in it. It's very granular, and those range from, you know, the bankruptcy claims that we do with Europa Investimenti, our Italian subsidiary, through to the mortgage servicing we do in White Star, which is our Portuguese subsidiary, through to, so if you go through the different examples, obviously the fee rates for servicing a Portuguese mortgage and the fee rate for serving an Italian bankruptcy is not the same, right? And so it's not going to be as simple unless we literally publish a 26-page rate card and do, like, labyrinthine segmentals. It's not going to be as simple as the bottom-up clarity you'd have on a high-yield fund. But you're still right that fundamentally we need to, as a majority of whereas an increasing relevant element comes in from management fees, servicing fees, and carry, we do hear you loud and clear that by product, by forward roll, we need to make it clear what's the AUM and fee capture. Phil's summary, which is that the assets, if you blend them to an average yield in net 10, and the fee capture is a net 30% of ROA on the third-party money, is right. And so given we've only announced the real estate fund in April and the lending fund today, We felt like we had more time to kind of publish the forward roll of that, but we appreciate the impatience and want to make sure this is easy to model and not hard to model.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. That's all for me, and I'm looking forward to that granularity, and we can also take that offline if you like. We can follow up with Phil.
Thanks, Marina. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It appears no further question at this time.
All right. Appreciate the call and the good discussion. We look forward to following up with you. Please connect with us if you want to do any of that additional analysis offline, and look forward to talking to you on the full year results early in 2024. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining today's call. You may now disconnect.